That shines in me, there's a light that shines in you. It's the same light that shines in each and every one of us, for we are one. Welcome once again to One Love Center Presents Book Study. One Love Center Presents The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. Welcome. And certainly, I know that the light that shines in you is shining brightly everywhere you go at all times. My name is Rodney Gittins, and I'm your host tonight. And my co-host, Hajar Rahim, will most likely join us, as will our guest contributor, who is becoming a regular contributor, we'll just say. And that is Muwatta Rasuli out of the East Bay area of California. And we welcome them when they show up, and I welcome you right where you are. So I know that this session, this evening, this radio broadcast is already a wonderful divine success because it's already got you, and you are what makes it so. And I give thanks knowing that there is wonderful, wonderful information being shared here. I give thanks to Eckhart Tolle for his presenting the power of now for all of us. I give thanks that we are able to do a discourse of it. We're able to dissect it and find greater relevancy in our lives through the power of now. So once again, I thank you all for being present and know that we are in for a wonderful ride. This is a ride of love, a ride of one love. So I'd like to also let you know that we are One Love Center. Who and what we are is that we are, I would say, a branch, an arm, a member of the Centers for Spiritual Living. One Love Center is a place where love grows. We actually do meet in person. We're not only virtually live, we are live. We meet on the first and third Sunday of every month at 11:30 a.m. That's the first and third Sunday of the month, 11:30 a.m. We meet at the Village at Gareje. It's a Rene Albertson Martin Gallery space, and it's a wonderful community space. It's at 886 Pacific Street, Brooklyn, New York, 11236. That's 886 Pacific Street in Brooklyn. 11236. If you know the area or if you plan to visit, it's between Washington Avenue and Underhill Avenue, very close to Atlantic Avenue. There's a number to the gallery, and that number is 718-857-2522. So, once again, my name is Rodney Gittins. I'm a licensed spiritual practitioner with One Love Center and Centers for Spiritual Living. I'm the spiritual director of One Love Center. It's a Brooklyn teaching chapter. You can reach us at 917-755-1418. And we have an email, which is onelove, that's O-N-E-L-O-V-E, at onelovecenter.org. And the website is www.onelovecenter.org. That's onelovecenter.org. onelovecenter.org. So please let us know. Give us a ring. Send us an email. Let us know that you're listening. Tell a friend. And certainly we'd love for you to show up on Sunday. We have a great Sunday fellowship. We are created a community of fellowship, meditation, prayer, sacred service, spiritually supported healing services. We have spiritual speakers, musical transformances, study workshops, and spiritual films. And we thank you for your participation, whether you're listening to us live or through the archives. Thank you, and thank you all, and most certainly feel free to contribute, to donate. We are a licensed 501c3, so if you do contribute, you most certainly are able to leave a tax-deductible donation to PayPal. Just find us at PayPal One Love Center. And I'd like to welcome our other participants here. We have Hadra Rahim, the co-host, and Moata Rasuli. Would you both please say hi? Hadra, are you present?
Moata's present.
And we have, we'll say hello.
Hello. I'm loving the show. It's always a delight to be here. Sorry I missed you last week.
Well, it's a delight to have you, and we're glad that you're here now, because that's what we're talking about, the power of now. So we're recognizing your power right now. Thank you. Thank you for making that easy
case,
for me.
In that case, I take my apology back.
Okay. And I accept that. Yes, indeed. Okay, so for our listeners and maybe those who are listening for the first time, we have Moata Rasuli, and he is the Reverend Moata Rasuli. Please not only introduce yourself, but let us know where you're from and what you do.
Well, now where I'm from is a curious question, but my center is in San Francisco. I'm with the San Francisco Center for Spiritual Living, and we're a trans-denominational spiritual community where love is the only option, and it is the focus and the forefront of everything we think, say, and do. We're all-inclusive. We welcome everyone, and I'm very excited and very blessed. I'm very grateful to be there, and I think I've been there. This is my 19th year.
Mm-hmm.
So they seem to, be content with me. And I'm certainly more than thrilled to be with them.
Well, thank you. And I'm sure it's even more powerful than that. That's the power of love for sure. Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that. And if you're in the San Francisco area, make sure
280 Claremont Boulevard. Yes, 280 Claremont Boulevard, just outside the West Portal train station.
And I've gotten there by myself all the way from New York City. So if I can do it, I'm sure those who are looking to do it can get there as well. And
that's true.
Yes, indeed. So We are...
Now, Hadra are today, huh?
Well, let's see. Hadra, are you present? Okay, well, I'm sure when she is, she will let us know.
She'll let us know, absolutely.
Yes. So we are in Chapter 9. Beyond happiness and unhappiness, there is peace. And we've already jumped into it a little bit already, and what we're going to do is continue. We'll probably backtrack just a little bit, just as a little recap. And let's see. Well, let's pick it up from... Let's start on the page. I'm in the hardcover, 147. And the part that that sticks out for me is whenever, and it's in the middle, towards the end of the paragraph, whenever anything negative happens to you, there is a deep lesson concealed within it, although you may not see it at the time. Even a brief illness or an accident can show you what is real and unreal in your life, what ultimately matters and what doesn't. Now, that's, you know, it's a pretty interesting paragraph, because he follows it up with, seen from a higher perspective, conditions are always positive. To be more precise, they are neither positive nor negative. They are as they are. And when you live in complete acceptance of what is, which is the only sane way to live, there is no, in quotes, good or bad in your life anymore. There is only a higher good, which includes the, in quotes, bad. So I think it's here he's kind of dancing in between the higher consciousness, the higher perspective, and the lower perspective, in an attempt to bridge us with an understanding that it just all is.
Where exactly did you read that again?
It's in the hardcover, page 147. This is chapter 9, and it starts off towards the here in my book, it's the third or fourth paragraph, that whenever anything negative happens to you, then it continues, seen from a higher perspective.
Okay, gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, so what I get from that is he's really just saying that life just is. It's not good or bad, except that when we're on a lower perspective, since he's saying seen from a higher perspective, when we're looking at life from a lower vibration, from that lower vibration of things are happening to me, you know, low stage of growth, if it can be called growth, or victimhood. So when we're looking at a level of victimhood and labeling and just looking at life as happening to us, therefore, things could be good. We would label things good or bad. And a higher perspective, we would just say that they are neither positive or negative. They just are. It is what it is.
Yep. It's done unto you as you believe.
Yeah, yeah. I think I remember in somewhere in A Course in Miracles, where there was it may have been in the beginning, just a practice of that life is empty and meaningless, you know, that things just happen. You know,
it's empty and meaningless, that life is empty and meaningless.
Right, yeah.
Is that the way that goes? Life is empty and meaningless, and it's empty and meaningless, that life is empty and meaningless. Like, don't try to put anything in that or on that or make it into some kind of brilliant thing. It's just... I remember people were saying that a lot back in the day.
Yeah.
What the heck are they? Your life is empty and meaningless, and it's empty and meaningless that life is empty and meaningless. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a great setup. You know, it's a great setup to begin to make choice.
Yes. you know, to live in a state where, you know, this whole thing about no good and no bad, you know, that really bothers people. And this is where a lot of people are going to sign off and check out, because each of us have had something bad happen to us.
Mm-hmm.
Each of us has got some low down, no good, scurvy, backstabbing, belly crawling, you know what's in our life that deserve what's coming to them. And
right.
So, and oftentimes we're just not ready to accept the fact that they don't have anything coming to them. And everything that we have in store for them, we're going to get first, and they may never see it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's like people are looking for life to be fair. And basically, this is the antithesis of fair and the foundation of the phrase, life's not fair.
Right.
And so unless you're prepared to deal with an unfair world, which means to most people, if life's not fair, then they're being victimized.
That's right.
Okay, this is a deep, you know, deep calling here. This is where you know, the advanced students, you know, those who choose the path start to, you know, feel the incline of the climb. Because you have to set all the captives in your mind free, emancipate yourself from your own victimization, and accept the fact that everything that happens to you is benefiting you. And so it's like, you know, well, how can you, you know, it runs counter to, you know, if you be good, good things will happen. And if you do bad, bad things happen, which is how we're indoctrinated.
Interesting.
So it's a tough call for a lot of people. And
I think especially since people have who knows how many generations of agreeing to what good is supposed to be, it's like and waiting on that good, and you can have generations after generations in one family of waiting for that good, waiting for the ship to roll in, waiting, and missing out by waiting, missing out on good that is already happening, except that we've got the blinders on to what good is supposed to look like. And I think what happens
yes,
is, you know, bad is anything that we don't consider good. You know, if it's not the good I'm looking for, then it's bad, you know. So there could
pretty
be
much
a whole lot more bad than so people can experience in their lives a lot more bad than good, because their expectation of good is so low. Does that make any sense?
Well, yeah, but that's, and so, you know, I don't know, actually, it seemed to make sense, Fred.
Yeah, it does. But I think that's a trap.
It is a trap, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. And like I said, it's not for lightweights. You know, this is when you separate, you know, and I don't like to talk about separation, but I've seen a lot of people check out right here. It's like, you know, what about the bad people on the planet? What about the Charlie Mansons? What about the, you know, Hitlers and the Idi Amins and Ayatollahs and, you know, these people who've kidnapped these girls right now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how are you going to go to a place where you can say, well, you know, this is not bad? You know, what justification, you know, what sane person would say this is not a bad thing that these girls were kidnapped from school,
mm-hmm.
you know, because somebody's making a point.
Right.
It's difficult for me to say it, you know. I mean, on a cosmic level, I get it,
mm-hmm.
you know. On a human, you know, and I don't like to call the cosmic level different from the human level. So I like to talk about, you know, on the cosmic level, which is also a human level, you know, I understand it in the realm of duality.
Right.
In the realm of duality, it's like, you know, I would do something bad to these people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, okay, so bless me and forgive me for conjuring up that energy and dump it into the cosmic pool and forgive them also, because neither one of us really know what we're doing. And
right.
It's like one thing about it, you know, they've raised the consciousness of the plight of women around the planet 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because everybody knows about this and everybody thinks it's awful. And the only people who don't think it's awful are people who are just completely out of touch.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, go ahead.
I mean, this is just a, you know, this is a hard, hard lesson here that he's teaching. You know? This is not something you put at the beginning of the book. You know,
right.
At the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there's so many examples, you know, it's hard to let go. I mean, you know, if you're a Democrat, it's always a Republican's fault. If you're a Republican, it's always a Democrat's fault. If you're steeped in duality, it's always something wrong with somebody else out there. And this is, you know, the whole allegory of the Garden of Eden, where mm-hmm. they ate of the tree of knowledge of good
right.
and evil. Before they had that, there was no knowledge of good and evil. So life just was.
Mm-hmm.
And the admonishment was, don't eat that, because that's going to mess you up.
Right.
You won't be able to stay in the garden, because in the garden, everything is whole, perfect, and complete. But if you eat that, well, you'll see the differences in things, and you won't be able to call everything whole, perfect, and complete anymore, and that's your automatic expulsion from the garden. And the way to get back to the garden is to go back to where you lose sight of the knowledge of good and evil.
All right. Absolutely. And that is to a higher knowing. That it's a
yes.
higher knowing that you know, life just is. I mean, you know, when and right now I'm going to open the line up because I believe Hajra has joined us, and you know, I just want to say hi, Hajra. Welcome.
Thank you, and well, thank you very much. Sorry I'm late.
Okay, not late. You're in perfect time because
perfect
you're here
time.
Now.
Yeah,
just
now
another opportunity to say welcome now.
Thank you.
Yeah, you know, when there are people who don't like to watch the nature shows where the lion is about to pounce on the game, you know, on the little thing that it's chasing, or and they're like, oh no, that's bad, that's evil, you know, and it just is. It's nature. You know, and very often, you know, just things that happen, you know, we want to give them that label of bad or evil or wrong.
Right.
And, you know, and yes, when people do things to other people, you know, and I call it not life-affirming, you know, and basically we realize when we get into deeper teachings that they're not recognizing what love is and how to express love, and all they're doing is coming from a place of not understanding what it is to love, to be loved, and you know, allow for love to make those decisions in their lives. And so in the book, in The Power of Now, he leads it into forgiveness. He says, you're not pretending anything. You're not pretending that so-called bad things don't happen, or what we call bad things don't happen. Something dreadful happens. You know, he says, I can pretend that it isn't bad, but the fact remains that it is bad. Why deny it? Eckhart Tolle writes that you're not pretending anything. You're allowing it to be as it is. That's all. This allowing to be takes you beyond the mind with its resistance patterns that create the positive-negative polarities. So he's introducing another idea. It is an essential aspect of forgiveness. Forgiveness of the present is even more important than forgiveness of the past. If you forgive every moment, allow it to be as it is, then there will be no accumulation of resentment that needs to be forgiven at some later time. He says, we're not talking about happiness. When a loved one has just died or you feel your own death approaching, he says, you cannot be happy. It is impossible, he says, but you can be at peace. So now he's introducing the peace that transcends happiness and sadness. He says, there may be sadness and tears, but provided that you have relinquished resistance, underneath the sadness, you will find a deep serenity. a stillness, a sacred presence. This is the emanation of being. This is inner peace, the good that has no opposite. So, you know, Reverend Watson, you did mention that, you know, this is a heavy piece. We've kind of really moved off of the good and bad in one respect, because he's introducing another idea of forgiveness of the present, you know, in the now, and he's introducing what resistance is. Resistance.
Yes.
Of the now.
The accumulation.
Because when we accept things in the present moment, there's nothing to accumulate, and therefore there's no resistance to what is.
I like it, because it just, his definition then is, I mean, what I'm getting from it.
Mm-hmm.
Did he actually use the word resentment?
Yes, he does. I believe he does. Let's see. He says, there will be no accumulation of resentment. He says, okay, if you forgive every moment, allow it to be as it is. This is in the middle of page 148 in the hardcover. He says, then there will be no accumulation of resentment that needs to be forgiven at some later time.
That's really good. I mean, basically he's calling resistance resentment.
Yeah.
It's the resistance to things being the way they are within you that causes resentment. And that resentment is basically the accumulation of all the resistance you've had to things being the way they are.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
And I believe that there's no time factor there. So any moment of resistance is a moment of resentment.
Yeah.
Because the way out of the resistance is to stop the resentment, which means to use forgiveness. So it could be a second, or it could be 50 years, or any time in between. So resistance...
Well, here's the thing about it, too.
Yeah.
He talks about no need to go back and forgive in the past, just start taking care of not being in resistance in the future, in the present.
Right.
And that's because your resistance and your resentment occur in the present, not the past. I'm angry now. I have resentment about what happened before. What happened before happened before.
Right.
If I was angry before and I got over it, I'm not angry now. If I was angry before and I didn't get over it, I'm still angry. I have resentment, which would be anger from the past, which is my resistance to the way things are. I'm saying they shouldn't have been that way, and they should be that way now, and something else should have happened, so I'm upset about it. Mm-hmm. It's my resistance. I'm loving it. Symmetry is, you know, my resistance is my resentment.
Mm-hmm.
My resentment is my resistance.
And
number
as long
one
as we're in
disappears.
Right. As long as we're in resistance, we're going to be in resentment. That's huge for me,
because resentment is something I know very well. I have an intimate relationship with resentment.
and it seems quite possible that we can be in intimate relationships that are not friendly, that are not positive and helpful. So it would seem.
It seemed like it was helping me at the time, but in retrospect, I realize it's not. All it does is it keeps me angry and small and petty. It keeps me stuck in a dimension of duality and where there's no possibility of reconciliation in the realm of duality. That's why this is an advanced conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Because in reality, I mean, on a higher plane, he's talking about forgiveness, but forgiveness is the realization that there has been a harm that I have to move past. Mm-hmm. I think there's another place where you just acknowledge that, you know, all that is. And I think that's what he's going to get there further on in the reading, I'm sure.
Yeah, he's going to continue.
All
back
it is,
that.
Is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, however, we are talking about the human plane at this level. And on this level, we have to go through that layer of forgiveness just to bring peace within our own mind and to release our resistance to it. That's what forgiveness to me is all about, releasing your resistance to whatever happened and just accept it as it just happened, and that's what it was. And I was a part of that experience. But to hold on to the anger and the resentment of what happened because you didn't like the particular outcome of how it was or who said what or who did what to you or who thwarted you or whatever, it keeps it in play and you continue to generate negative energy.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, the spiritual tool to me, and I think forgiveness should be up there with spiritual mind treatment and meditation, to something that we should do regularly, like he's talking about here, every moment, day by day, you know, because we live in this world of duality, and we have to practice forgiveness until we rise above that thinking of duality and see it, it just is, it's just life, and that's how things happen, and we can just move on from that, learn our lessons, and move on. But until we do that, we are into forgiveness, yes.
Yeah. Seeing life from the from a lower perspective, and I truly believe that it is the aim of us human, you know, animal beings to exercise the potentiality of a higher consciousness. And that's not to say that other forms of being on the planet, other animals, don't have that capacity, because we don't really know. But that's why we're here. It's to elevate our consciousness. I mean, that's kind of like how I see it. You know, about resentment, or in my early 12-step experiences, there was some wonderful sayings about resentments, and I hope that they're not too graphic. But one of them, the first one, is about resentments, is that you're the only one who feels it.
Right.
You know, it's like whatever we're thinking and we're holding on to and feeling about the past and what somebody did or what didn't happen, and we carry it along through life, we're the only ones who feel it. And we think we're...
How dare you speak to me that way?
That's
How dare
right.
you speak to me that way, sir?
That's right. That's right.
I resemble that remark.
That's right. That's right. And so that's the one thing. And then the next thing
Where'd
is...
Where did you get that from?
What's that?
Where is that from?
Resemble that remark?
No, that's Norm Crosby. I know that, but what about
oh, okay.
you're the only one who feels it?
Right.
Is that
well,
12-step
I got that
or what?
From going to 12-step meetings. I don't know where they got it from, but resentments,
that's
you
a
know...
Good one.
But what happens is it leads to another wonderful little saying... that having a resentment is like spitting into the wind.
It comes back at you.
It goes right back at you. And it gets
and
even more graphic.
Right,
it's like,
and there's another one that says having unforgiveness is like drinking poison and thinking the other person's going to die.
That's right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It all comes right back on us. And,
what's the other
and
more
also,
graphic one?
What's that?
Yeah. Give me the next one you got. These are all good.
Yeah.
Are these all good?
The next one is,
you know,
when we're... That, say it again, Hajra.
One of the things that when I first came into the teachings with Reverend Jim Munson, God rest his soul, he said that whatever you do in consciousness, whatever thought you have out there, you keep the original and the other person just gets the copy. You know?
Oh, my God. You know your Jim Munson was your teacher?
Yes. What?
I'm sorry. Well, to just full circle, we're having this conversation about forgiveness. I have a forgiveness I have to work with Jim Munson.
Okay.
So then we know that there's no accident why this is coming up now.
It's like I've known you all this time. I never knew this about you.
Yeah.
My
yep.
goodness, my goodness. Wow, wow. That's funny right there. That's funny right there.
And then he went down to California.
Yeah, that's where I met him.
Yeah.
In living color.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You
got to
realize. Go ahead.
He had just left New York, Seattle, moved to California. That's when we got a couple of years later, we got Kathy Ann.
And
yeah.
That is
no.
Kathy Ann Lewis, correct?
Yeah, she's
okay.
been there since, yeah.
And she's the senior minister of Center for Spiritual Living, Seattle.
Right.
Okay. So, and that's great. So I think maybe we can even maybe get into a little bit more. But it also reminds me, and it brings up the next little statement, is that when, and what happens a lot with unforgiveness and resentments, when we have resentments, we have one foot in yesterday. Our attention and focus is on yesterday and what happened. And we have another foot in tomorrow. And we're not living in today. And so when you have one foot in tomorrow and a foot in yesterday, it quite will most likely look like we're pissing on today.
From a male perspective, yes.
Yeah. So,
no, only from the male perspective. Okay, that's funny right there.
Yeah, right. Well, I guess it could be either gender, but...
I don't understand why that's. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm trying not to, you know, to expand the metaphor any more than we already have. But
yes,
come on, Audra. From the male perspective, are you serious?
Well, you know, that's what I've witnessed in my life. That's all I can tell you.
Well, and what it means, you know, less graphically, is that we're not at all focused on our life in the now today.
Right.
And we will not be centered in today, and therefore we will not be focused, and we will have plenty of resentment and giving our power away,
mm-hmm.
and thinking or thinking that we're giving it away. And so when we look further about what Eckhart Tolle says about forgiveness, he says, through forgiveness, which essentially means recognizing the insubstantiality of the past and allowing the present moment to be as it is, the miracle of transformation happens not only within, but also without. And that's what really it's about. It's about freedom. He said, you dissolve discord, heal pain, dispel unconsciousness without doing anything, simply by being and holding that frequency of intense presence. He says, that's the power of forgiveness, being in the now and becoming conscious.
That's pretty good.
When he says
fully conscious, it's like it's a conscious activity of allowing things to be as they are. You know, my theme for the month of May is woohoo, allow. You know, just, you know, there's something really exciting about just letting things be the way they are. You know, I hear Doris Day, que sera, sera.
Whatever will be, will be.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he also said that doesn't mean you don't do anything about what's going on, but you do it from a different level of mind where things can be, if things need to be corrected, then they can be corrected, you know. Which means you don't just stand there and watch your house burn down because it's burning. You call the fire department. But you don't get into blame and all that other stuff about what happened, why it happened. You just need to take care of what needs to be taken care of at that time, without going into anger and resentment and all that stuff.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't mean don't take action when action
right.
is called for. It just
right.
means what you think about it, what you believe about it, you know, will determine your action.
Yep. Right, exactly. So I just want to make that point, you know, because a lot of times when people say certain things, they don't put the other half to it, you know?
Well, I remember Michael Beckwith, Reverend Michael Beckwith. I was at a Revelations, I think probably my first one, and he was talking about people who are airy-fairy, like, oh, all is good, it's all good, you know, everything's going to work out just fine, you know, and they're not very connected. They're not connected to you know, they're really connected to their higher self, but they're just like, well, okay, well, I guess an example would be, well, the house is burning down. I guess we'll just let it burn. No, it means you can take action. You can call the fire department and say, hey, you know, there's a fire. You know, call the people to put out the fire. It doesn't mean, well, all that's just the way life is. You know, and he called that airy-fairy, meaning that, you know, accepting what is different than just, I mean, accepting and allowing is one thing. But then letting the actions be non-responsive is an issue.
Right.
That's not necessarily being holy or being spiritual.
Right.
So that's a great point, Hadra. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm sorry, I got cut off for a minute. What was the point that I missed?
The point is allowing what is or accepting what is, that that's what it is. If it's, Hadra made an example of, if there's a house on fire,
oh, yeah,
it's
yeah.
one thing to accept it, but that doesn't mean that you don't get to take action. Of course, you can take action. You're not going to run around blaming, hey, look what happened, or who did this, you know, take care of the situation. You know, respond appropriately as well as accept what is. Some people would just get upset and angry and start yelling, but that may not be the proper thing to do in the moment, appropriate thing to do in the moment. Yeah, we can still accept what is and still take care of business.
Right.
So I can apprehend the abductors of those girls and maybe shoot them dead. Just don't be pissed off at them. Is that what you're saying?
Just don't be pissed off at
them? Just don't be angry when I shoot them. Just be at peace when I pull the trigger. Is that it?
Well, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying if that's appropriate action, I think they would have to answer to the law. You know, the law that would deal with them once they're apprehended. That might be what the appropriate action is. It might be up to the people who apprehend them in the moment. I don't know. I mean, if it's a firefight, you know, then I guess that might be what happens. If they surrender,
That's the point I'm making. Let's put this in practical terms. This is a nice esoteric conversation.
Sure.
You know, but that's basically saying, you know, if you have to throw down, you might have to throw down in the moment. But
sure.
But the trick is to be at peace while you're throwing down. This is what a true martial artist is going to stay at a zero point. Well,
right.
He does what he does because it's not personal. You lose potency. You lose power. Your chi diminishes mm-hmm. with rage.
Right.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, this is a real conversation. Maybe you have to, you know, have to get busy.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And it could be well within maybe the law of the land. Or maybe it's a spiritual law, but it's the law that whatever's put out, you know, there's going to be a response. There's going to be a reaction. There's going to be a response. And for each person, we'll have to depend on where they're at. I mean, because we get to ultimately live with ourselves by our actions and reactions and responses. So I think
There's an old story. I don't know who tells this story, but I've heard it for a long time. About Prince Nasruddin. Was it Nasruddin? Arjuna. And he has to go to battle. There's a great battle looming the next day. And he's very sad. Because a lot of the people that he's going to have this great epic battle with are members of his own family that are fighting for the other side. And he's lamenting the fact that he's going to have to slaughter his own family to win this battle. And his advisor is Lord Krishna. And Lord Krishna comes to him and says, you know, you don't have to hate them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You don't have to hate them. You're going to kill them, but you don't have to hate them.
That's right. Yeah.
Don't have to hate them. Yes.
And that's a whole. It's like, what the heck? You know, this is some advanced, serious. This is, you know, take it out of the esoteric and bring it into the real.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it becomes
right.
part of that. It becomes that part of that impersonal love, that impersonal thing of action, because you're operating now on principle, not in terms of who did what, but what's the principle involved here, and what needs to happen in regards to the principle, and what's the consequent action that would call forth that thing. And so when we get into that state of looking as objectively or as objectively as we can, look at something and say, okay, so what would be the appropriate action to take to resolve the situation so the situation can be peaceful, you know? But it takes a higher level of looking at what's going on and a lot of spiritual development and looking at what's going on in order to not succumb to that ego level of being angry, resentful, blaming, shaming, and all that stuff. So it's a pretty high consciousness thing to look at something. And I know when I was in college, they talked about being a disinterested observer, you know, not being attached to the outcome, just observing what was going on and draw some conclusions from that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, one thing for sure, we've thank you for that, Hajar. We definitely have touched on that we're the ones that go through it. You know,
right.
We're the ones that experience all of this, and Eckhart Tolle says drama. All right?
Right.
I'm on page 150 in the hardcover, The Power of Now. It says the end of your life drama.
Mm-hmm.
He says in that state of acceptance and inner peace, even though you may not call it bad, can anything still come into your life that would be called bad from a perspective of ordinary consciousness? So Eckhart Tolle answers this idea, this question. Most of the so-called bad things that happen in people's lives are due to unconsciousness. They are self-created, or rather ego-created. And it's self-created with a small s, or rather ego-created. He says, I sometimes refer to those things as drama. When you are fully conscious, drama does not come into your life anymore. He says, let me remind you briefly how ego operates and how it creates drama. He reminds us that ego is the unobserved mind that runs your life when you are not present as the witnessing consciousness, the watcher. The ego perceives itself as a separate fragment in a hostile universe with no real interconnection to any other being, surrounded by other egos, which it either sees as a potential threat or which it will attempt to use for its own ends. He says these are the basic ego patterns that are designed to combat its own deep-seated fear and sense of lack. They are resistance, control, power, greed, defense, attack. Some of the ego strategies are extremely clever, yet they never truly solve any of its problems, simply because the ego itself is the problem. Yeah, and so I heard Mwanza mention briefly, you know, it's about fear. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's always about fear. And it says, goes on to say, when egos come together, whether in personal relationships or in organizations or institutions, in quotes, bad things happen sooner or later. Drama of one kind or another, in the form of conflict, problems, power struggles, emotional or physical violence, and so on. This includes collective evils such as war, genocide, and exploitation, all due to masked unconsciousness. Furthermore, many types of illnesses are caused by the ego's continuous resistance, which creates restrictions and blockages in the flow of energy throughout the body. When you reconnect with being, and are no longer run by your mind, you cease to create those things. You do not create or participate in drama anymore.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that drama.
Yeah, that drama is something else. And I witnessed this woman create some drama herself. I mean, we were just sitting there, everything was peaceful, and she just had to, we call it, just start something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And she just kind of just took one little thing that happened and just made it out of this big thing. My other girlfriend used to call it yeasting. She yeasted it up, you know, yeast makes things rise. So she took one little incident and threw some yeast in there, and before you know it, you know, other people reacting to her. And I'm looking at her create this whole scene. I'm like, she couldn't stand the peace. She couldn't stand the quiet because the ego was there.
And it says that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It has to, I mean, I used to wonder why. It has to create something because it has to have something to do to stay in control.
Sure.
And so I just witnessed that. It was just amazing to see it.
Well, he says here in the book, it says, whenever two or more egos come together, drama of one kind or another ensues. But even if you live totally alone, you still create your own drama. When you feel sorry for yourself, that's drama. When you feel guilty or anxious, that's drama. When you let the past or future obscure the present, you are creating time, psychological time, the stuff out of which drama is made. Whenever you are not honoring the present moment by allowing it to be, you are creating drama. Now, the next sentence, I think most people can attest to, it says, most people are in love with their particular life drama. Their story is their identity. Their ego runs their life. And if you're not claiming it for yourself, then maybe you know somebody who does that.
Right.
And I can think of...
minds want to know.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
I said, inquiring minds want to know.
Yeah, they do. You know, and usually we're not going to find it in the mirror. You know, it's easier to look at it happening from somebody else than we can see in our own lives.
Right.
I mean, I think driving on the way home from work today, there were people who just were insistent on getting in front of me. You know, there was traffic. We weren't going that fast, and I wasn't going fast enough for them, and they kept trying to get around me. And so in my mind, they were trying to get around me, slowing me down, getting in my way, and I was creating drama.
Yes.
And I was technically, at that moment, the only one really feeling it. And they were creating their own drama, you know, by maybe trying to get in front of me, not me personally, but the next car in front of them. You know, so I take it personally. And, you know, it's like I'm going through this little inner battle of, oh, doesn't matter. I'll get there when I get there. They can't get in front of me. Who do they think they are? Don't they know who I am? I have every bit to be, you know, right to be on the road. Just like they do, you know, they can't hurry me up, you know. It's like this little battle back and forth. And so I'm creating my own drama, you know, and it didn't matter because I still got to where I was going.
Yeah.
And so for those moments, I was not at peace. Even if I thought I was so-called, in quotes, winning.
Right. You're not at peace.
Yeah. No,
yeah.
Not at peace.
I want to ask a question about, this is the thing, I would love to have my conversation, I'd love to have a conversation with Eckhart. Maybe I should get into one of his, maybe he probably has a chat room or a place, a forum or something, but, you know, his premise of what the ego is interesting. I like it. Ego is the unobserved mind that runs your life when you are not present as the witnessing consciousness, the watcher. The ego perceives itself as a separate fragment in a hostile universe with no real interconnection to any other being, surrounded by other egos which either sees as a potential, which it either sees as a potential threat or will attempt to use for its own ends. The basic ego patterns are designed to combat its own deep-seated fear and sense of lack. All we didn't talk about it, resistance, control, power, greed, defense, attack, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
My question is this. If the ego is the unobserved mind, or the, how do you say it, the unobserved mind, Why does the unobserved mind perceive itself as separate? How did the unobserved mind get the idea it was separate?
Because it's believing that it's, my thought about that is the ego mind, the mind, he uses mind and ego interchangeably also, is that it's the ego's job to get things done. And, you know, at any cost, on the physical level. And my interpretation of that is that it thinks it has the power, and therefore it thinks that it's in control. And so therefore that creates something separate.
So why or how does it think that? Where does that thought come from? It's the unobserved mind. So somehow the unobserved mind thinks it's a fragment. Why does it think it's a fragment? I mean, this is a question I'm just exploring. It's a thought puzzle for me.
Mm-hmm.
And what I get as I go down this rabbit hole is that the observed mind must have programmed the unobserved mind with this information, i.e., as we grew up and we were taught to fear, taught to be angry, taught to have, you know, resentments and lack and limitations, we accepted that in our conscious, observed mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the observed mind programmed the unobserved observing mind so that it's getting its marching orders from awareness. As awareness changes, it reprograms the ego into something different. If God is all there is, if oneness is all there is, then the ego is not created to be separate or bad or fragmented or hostile. So
mm-hmm.
Where did that idea come from? I mean, that's all I'm just looking at. I'm not disputing what he's saying.
Right.
I'm just saying, how did it get to be that way? And
right.
Maybe it got to be that way, the way I'm describing it.
Right. Well, according to Ernest Holmes, right, you don't ever get rid of your ego because your ego is who is your individualized expression. But you don't let the ego run the show. You let the higher consciousness run the show because the ego is what gets you up in the morning to get done what you need to get done without having the attachments to the outcome. But you get up and you go forth and you get done what you need to get done. That's your ego. But when its ego gets blown out of proportion, it's when it starts thinking that it's separate and nobody else is there and I have to do it myself and look at me, I'm the greatest, you know, I'm the latest, I'm the greatest, and everything is all about me. Then it's out of control. And so I wouldn't say just ego. I would say an out-of-control ego because we need our ego. Our ego
yeah.
is our self-identity on this plane.
Now, Eckhart Tolle...
My question remains the same. How does the ego get out of control?
Well, let me read this. I have something to read. It says, this is early on in The Power of Now, we have passed this quite a while ago. It says, the term ego means different things to different people, but when I use it here, it means a false self created by unconscious identification with the mind. He says, to the ego, the present moment hardly exists. Only past and future are considered important. So it is, he goes on to say, there was another point I wanted to make.
I'd like to hear that again.
What page are you reading on?
It says, it's a false self. Ego, he uses the term ego as a false self created by unconscious identification with the mind, meaning that we identify with the mind unconsciously. It says, to the ego, the present moment hardly exists. Only past and future are considered important.
Unconscious identification with the mind. What the heck does that mean?
Well, we have to go back to...
What chapter are you in?
This is probably the first chapter that says, you are not your mind.
What page are you on?
I was on 18.
Okay.
But he starts talking about mind. And this, again, is his understanding of mind, which is not necessarily going to be the same as it is in New Thought or, you know, in other disciplines.
Well, you know, Muwatta, what you're asking is that eternal esoteric question about how life got to be the way it is. You know?
Yeah.
And there are a lot of different points of view as to what happened and how it happened and how we got into this state of unconsciousness and why do we need to evolve into higher consciousness we already got. What is that all about in the first place? Nobody really knows. Everybody has their opinion on what it is. But what we do know is that we wind up here on this plane in this world of polar opposite, in the world of duality, however you want to call it, and we have to rise above and unlearn a lot of things we've learned. We have to come to grips with a lot of things that we don't necessarily want to know about or want to deny or whatever. I mean, just in, you know, become the practitioner and the minister, you know, we need to go in and have people look at their unconscious beliefs that they picked up when they were kids, you know, and the experience and things that they had that formulated those beliefs. And then look at that and talk about, well, what was the truth of that, you know, because we have a lot of stuff that's unconscious there. So, yeah, and coming from that point of view of that unconsciousness and blaming other people for it and not taking responsibility for what we need to do to correct where we are in our life, because it's not about what my mama did, what my daddy did. It's about what I'm doing now. What am I doing with my life? How am I going to turn it around so I can have a better life, so I can get out of the conflicts, so I can get out of that ego-based drama and become a person that I like to be with myself? So I won't be home by myself creating all this drama in my mind. I know people who do that, and they're just always in a tidbit, and the next thing you know, they got some disease or something, you know? Because that's all that negative energy that you don't need to have in your life, but the person has to come to terms with that at some point that, you know, they say when you get sick and tired of being sick and tired, then you're ready for a change.
The mind is a superb instrument. Go ahead.
Well, I think that you're right, that you probably have to get him to explain it on that particular paragraph, because it does seem to be, I mean, it kind of folds on itself in trying to answer its make a statement about itself, where ego and mind are separate parts. However, he also uses them synonymously, if that's the right word. But
I'm in the. I went back because I wanted to know this, and you encouraged me to go back and look.
Okay.
And within the You Are Not Your Mind chapter, he's got a subtext of what is the greatest obstacle to experiencing this reality.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm in the paperback, and that's page 14. But if you look, you know, you can find exactly where that is, because he, in his table of contents, he breaks everything down so well as aware of what is. And so,
what did you find?
Well, I'm just reading it, and it's got some interesting things. Identification with your mind creates an opaque screen of content. Okay, that's identification with the mind. But what is the identification with your mind, which causes thought to become compulsive? Not to be able to stop thinking is a dreadful affliction, but we don't realize it because almost everybody is suffering from it, so it is considered normal. This incessant mental noise prevents you from finding that realm of inner stillness that is inseparable from being. It also creates a false mind-made self that casts a shadow of fear and suffering. We will look at all that in more detail later. So he's saying here, he's answering my question, this incessant mental noise from thinking prevents us from finding that realm of inner stillness that is inseparable from being. It also creates this infested mental noise from being, can also create a false mind-made self that casts a shadow of fear and suffering. So he's saying, I imagine, since the ego is an unconscious identification with the mind, that the mind is this false mind-made self that's casting a shadow of fear and suffering, and the ego is when you unconsciously identify with that.
Right.
So.
And that's,
that's
how
what I'm getting to.
Yeah. And that's good. And what happens is that happens unconsciously, you know, without our conscious awareness. And however, that's where we identify ourselves unconsciously. This is who I am. You know, I am a white man. I'm a black man. I'm male, female. I do this, I'm that. Like the story that we told the last time you were on with the master and the student walking down the road. And the soldiers walked up on them, and the master said, you know, hey, I am nobody. You know, he totally shut his ego down in that moment. You know, didn't associate himself as anything. And the student said, hey, I'm a student. You know. What's not to like? They didn't like students, and they beat them up. You know, that's like, you know, the ego had to, you know, label itself, associate itself as something, you know, with all, and who knows what kind of conversations was in the student mind, like, hey, I've got to classify myself as something, you know, and the ego does that. It's a, like it says, you know, it's a strategy. Ego has strategy. But it operated out of fear. You know, the student, acted out of fear. He didn't listen. He didn't follow his master, who was in a total state of peace. You know, he's like, hey, you know, hey, I'm a student. I don't know about this guy, but I'm a student. out of fear, that fear met with the soldiers who may have been afraid of students, and they got what they got.
Yeah.
So it says when egos come together, bad things happen sooner or later, you know. So the ego of the soldiers and the ego of the student got together and something bad. Now the teacher didn't present his ego, so nothing happened to him. It says when you reconnect with being, you are no longer run by your mind. You cease to create those things. You do not create or participate in drama anymore. So we're disempowering the unconscious association with the mind. We're disempowering the act of separation. I mean, I can't say that what Eckhart Tolle is saying is that the ego is saying, I'm going to create some separation here. You know, just by what it does creates separation, even a false sense of separation, because there really is no separation.
Well, because he describes, let me get this right again. The mental noise that prevents us from finding the realm of inner stillness, it also creates a false mind-made self that casts a shadow of fear and of suffering. The ego is that unconscious identification with the false mind-made self that casts shadow of fear and suffering. Well, heck, if it's casting a shadow of fear and suffering and you're unconsciously identifying it, then you see yourself as a false mind-made self that's casting a shadow of fear and suffering. So wherever you go, that's what you're creating, and you can start bringing people, everybody who thinks that, who's unidentifying with that same shadow of fear and suffering together, what you have is a bunch of people who think who they are is fear and suffering. So what are they going to create? Collective fear and suffering.
That's right.
And that's what I think he's saying. Is that what you think he's saying?
That's what it sounds like to me.
I got Richard on the news.
I mean, if love begets love, then fear begets fear. You know, it's like birds of a feather flock together.
Yes, indeed. So it's good stuff. You know, it's good stuff. I remember when I read this, I'm going to read it again because I didn't even want to read this new book when it came out because I was still digesting the new one, the old one.
Uh-huh.
So this is just, it's over 2 million copies sold on my paperback. That's a lot of books.
Yep.
All right, so as we move on from this part and start to bring the session to a fold, he says, when you are fully conscious, you cease to be in conflict. No one who is at one with himself or herself can even conceive of conflict, states A Course in Miracles. This refers not only to conflict with other people, but more fundamentally to conflict within you, which ceases when there is no longer any clash between the demands and expectations of your mind and what is. He says, polar opposites become mutually energized. He says, you can still make your point clearly and firmly, but there will be no reactive force behind it, no defense or attack, so it won't turn into drama. So I guess, Moata, when you're talking about, you know, maybe finding the people who kidnapped those girls, depending on the person's approach, you know, it won't be a reactive force necessarily. I don't know. I know it takes two, so somehow it won't turn in. It's possible that if the person is so consciously aware, that maybe that will precede them, and those people will let the girls go and give themselves up or lay down their arms, or, you know, there could be a peaceful solution to that.
Could be.
And I think as long as people are on the war path of finding those girls, that energy might also be met with that same force.
No doubt. I mean, that's an advanced course right there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Who do you send in with that consciousness? I mean, I'm like, I could go there and be one of those people.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I don't know how much it would take for me to revert. I guess I said I don't know how little it would take for me to revert back to my dualistic concept of reality.
Right. The only person I can think of that could even begin to go there would be the Dalai Lama.
You know, Nelson Mandela's gone. We can't use him.
Nope. Yeah. Dalai Lama's the one that's left.
Well, at least that we know of. I mean, and it could be any one of us. You know, if we were called to be that, to do that, we would be it. I'm sure. Knowing you both as I do.
I remember a time when my ex-wife had moved this guy into our house. And she told me that he was now the man of the house. And that if I wanted to see my daughters, I had to talk to him. Because he was in charge. And I'm telling her, well, he's going to have to tell me that himself. I'm not taking that from you, you know. If he's man enough to step to me and say that, then we'll have that conversation. But he can't send you. So I just kept coming over. But anyway, long story short, this guy winds up getting physically violent with her. And she wants me to get rid of the guy. And, of course, I tell her, you need to call the police because you're the one who put him in there. I can't put him out. And it goes back and forth. And finally she moves out because she's afraid. She moves out of her own house. Takes my kids out of the house because she's afraid of this guy. I remember one day just go over there after about 2 weeks of this. I said, I want to go talk to this guy. My brother's stopping me.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I'm not letting you go over there. I said, man, I just want to talk to him. He said, I know that's what you want to do, Muwata, but he's going to say something. He knows you're coming. You know, you're going to say something, and you're not going to feel like talking anymore. And it doesn't even make sense. You know, like I think about these little girls. I don't know if I could go because my best intention, how little would it take for me to lose sight of my consciousness? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm not strong enough. You know, I mean, your best intention sometimes to be conscious, you know, you really have to work hard. Consciousness is a full-time job.
And, yes, it is.
And so here we have a great opportunity to practice being. You know, I mean, what a splendid opportunity. So here's something good that's coming out of it. It's like people all over the world who are looking to practice a higher consciousness or a greater connectedness. I can't think of too many things, if anything at all, that gives me a greater opportunity than this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get worked up about too much stuff. You know, this has me worked up.
And you're right. It is a great opportunity, and I know from my earliest listenings to anything about the spiritual living, about religious science and new thought, has to do with that whatever I hear that I all of a sudden view as bad or wrong or harmful, it becomes a prayer request.
Yep.
Right.
Becomes an opportunity for me to go into that upper room, the higher consciousness, the higher awareness, and know the highest and the best in that situation. And so I think that's what I'm hearing from you, that's what it is. That's what it takes for us to do. And I do like when things happen, when it's a prayer for the planet, you know, and on the internet. It just circulates quickly by email. At such and such a time, we're going to all join in prayer, you know, and that might be one of these situations, you know, this is called for as well. You know, prayer for the people who are holding the hostages, prayer for the hostages, prayer for everybody who's thinking about the hostages, prayer for all of that, you know, for the best solution to that, the best outcome. You know, prayer in this respect is like you said, that's what's needed now, because I think the thoughts will certainly make the difference, what we're thinking about, even what we're talking about right now. You know, if we're talking about peace in this situation, that adds to the whole energy of people who are talking about peace in this situation. And I think that alone, like if any one of us were going into that situation, we would be carrying that high vibration with us. We would certainly want to be in that rarefied air, or instead of picking up a newspaper and reading about it all the way there, you know, because most likely the newspaper is not going to be talking about any realm of peace or a higher conscious awareness, you know. So,
you know, and when I think about it, I agree. And so here's the thing that I realize keeps me conscious and why I could go. I could go because I'm really aware of, I've been in death-defying situations before where my life was imminently threatened and all I had was consciousness, and I managed to stay conscious then. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, this is not the time for me to start getting scared and stop believing in God. You know? If you want to take an excursion from believing in God, let it be, you know, if nobody's around and nothing bad can happen, but there's imminent danger here. And so my focus heightened exponentially. And so I believe going into that situation, realizing that the safety of the girls is paramount.
Yeah.
There's no room for anything except harmony of being.
Mm-hmm.
Any deviation from that puts them at greater risk, and you don't need to be there. If you can't do it, don't show up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I had a client today, and he was wearing some prayer beads on his wrist. And I asked him, "Oh, do you pray? You know, do you chant?" And he said, "No, I just made them because it looks cool." But he said, "My father does. You know, his father does Buddhist chants." And so we started talking, and he said something that reminded me of the point that you just made, and all of a sudden it just slipped my mind.
The point that you have to be, I have to be conscious because the girls' lives are at risk.
Right.
And so any deviation from the wholeness of being, you got your point back?
Right, thank you. So he mentioned about walking on hot coals. And he said his father had walked on hot coals. And I said, well, yeah, I did too. I did it twice. And he was just astounded. And I said, well, you know, you have to have, you can't just go and walk on coals. You know, you have to prepare yourself. You know, you have to go into meditation. You have to really be centered. You have to have this high level of conscious awareness of oneness with your source that you can do anything. And when you do that, you can walk on coals. And you don't feel the heat. You know, you just don't have that experience at all. And I said, now, I told him, well, you know, I've done that, but I haven't walked on nails. You know, it's like I'd have to set myself up for that, you know. And so and that's what's really interesting. You have to really have that conscious awareness and be centered, deeply centered in it. So we don't just walk into the fray. Now, what it says here at the end of this little session, it says, when you live in complete acceptance of what is, that is the end of all drama in your life. Nobody can even have an argument with you, no matter how hard he or she tries. You cannot have an argument with a fully conscious person. You know? And that's what we're looking at, because we're already, that energy is preceding us, and that's kind of like how I'm picking up on that. You know, it's like there's nothing for it to come back to.
Right.
It's nothing for it to bounce off on. And my mom always said, it takes two to argue.
Mm-hmm.
And only a fool would argue with themselves. She would say, don't engage in the argument. You know?
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
it was just amazing because she wouldn't defend herself when my father would start up and start ranting and stuff. You know, she would just sit there and say, yes, yes, yes. Yes. And he'd have to stop because she wasn't giving him anything to go on. She wasn't resisting.
That's perfect. That's right. It says, he says, Eckhart Tolle, an argument implies identification with your mind and a mental position as well as resistance and reaction to the other person's position. The result is that the polar opposites become mutually energized. They are the mechanics of opposites. They are the mechanics of unconsciousness. You can still make your point clearly and firmly, but there will be no reactive force behind it, no defense or attack. So it won't turn into drama. When you are fully conscious, you cease to be in conflict. And that's where this quote from A Course in Miracles comes in again. No one who is at one with himself can even conceive of conflict. So as we move into these areas, and I guess it's even like how Jesus is the person in the Bible named Jesus, who is described as not healing anybody. He just sees everybody as whole, perfect, and complete. He sees the true nature of who they are. He's not seeing discord. He's not seeing anything wrong with them. He just says, hey, get up and walk. You know, it's like open your eyes and see or whatever. You know, it's like I don't see anything wrong with you. I don't see any conflict here. I don't perceive it. It doesn't really truly exist. I'm not, you know, I'm one with the source. You know, and I think that's where that's coming from. So it says this refers not only to conflict with other people, but more fundamentally to conflict within you, which ceases when there is no longer any clash between the demands and expectations of your mind and what is. And on that note, the next portion of this chapter is called Impermanence and the Cycles of Life. And it gets continues to get deep, talking about physical birth and death, and I think also how it moves into our conscious level of awareness in each moment, living and dying consciously in each moment. So we're going to save that for the next week. And I'd like to thank our guests. And I'm not even going to call him a guest, Reverend Moata Rasuli, with the awesome church in San Francisco, hailing from the East Bay. Thank you again for
you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Gracing us with your presence.
My pleasure. I feel graced by being here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I know that you are contributing to the healing on the planet, not only with this radio show, but in everything that you say, think, and do, because that is just who you are and why you're here. So thank you so much, and I love you.
I love you all. I love you both.
Thank you. And we have Hajar Rahim, my co-host and co-partner in One Love Center, knowing that, and who will be speaking on the 1st of June. She will be speaking, and the theme of the month is creativity. And Hajar will be leading that session in a wonderful, powerful way. We are One Love Center, Brooklyn Teaching Chapter. We meet the first and third Sunday of the month, 11:30 a.m., at the Village at Gureje, G-U-R-E-J-E, the Village at Gureje. It's a wonderful multi-use space, by the way, that if you have any activity that you'd like to do, that you can contact them and maybe join in the community there at the Village at Gureje. It is at 886 Pacific Street in Brooklyn, 11236, between Washington and Underhill Avenue. So, the One Love Center, first and third Sunday of the month. We do meet in person. Please join us and participate. Check us out online, www.onelovecenter.org, and we can be reached at 917-755-1418. We really thank you for participating with us today. We thank you for knowing that there is a great power inside of you that is moving and breathing and having its way and is wonderfully impacting each and every one of us. At One Love Vision, we envision a world, a sacred environment, where spiritual growth and development flourish through living in the practice of these spiritual principles. And in doing so, we get to provide a stable and welcoming community for all who choose to practice and grow, play and unfold their understanding of spiritual principles and spiritual living. So we invite you to practice spiritual living with us here in Blog Talk Radio as we continue to explore The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. Peace and blessings. And thank you. We're going to close with this wonderful prayer, words of truth, and knowing that right where you are, the very power and presence of God is, and know that you travel well now and before next week, that everything that you desire is happening in a wonderful way for you and for everyone in all areas of concern, of health, of wealth, of relationships, financially. Knowing that that blessing is ready and willing to invade your life with greater proportion of joy and love. And I know this for you. I know this for everyone. Peace and blessings. Let's listen to The Power Is Inside You by Stephen Wise. Well, guys. It's over. No more recording. Hello, Brenda. Hello, Brenda. Hello?
Yeah, okay, that's better.
Yeah, hey, Brenda? Hello? Somebody else is on the line.
Yeah.
Hey, there you are. Hi.
Hey, what's going on?
Woo.
Thank you, that was awesome.
Hey, how's it going?
Awesome, awesome.
Great, wonderful.
Good, good, good. Thank you, that was fun.
Yeah.
That was interesting how that came up for you and Mwata with, what was the reverend's name? What was his name?
Oh, Jim Munson?
Yes, Jim Munson. I've heard him mention him before.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Yeah.
I was, you know, so obviously he didn't want to get into it too much, but, you know.
Yeah.
But that's great because that brought up something that needs to be healed.
Right. Yeah,
good.
All I know is I was there, and, you know, to me, I mean, I was all new, so I really didn't know anything about any, underlying anything about what was going on, you know, and I still don't know, don't really care, but he just really impacted me with his teaching, so,
mm-hmm.
And then he left, he went down to California, for whatever reason, I don't even know why he left, but he did, and,
mm-hmm.
He was down there until he died.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Good, good, good.
His wife, so she, at the time, she was there also, and she, they got divorced, and she moved to back home to Missouri, and she remarried. And I've run into her at a couple of different places, so that was really, really kind of interesting to see her. Yeah, she was at the conference in February. She was there.
What's her name?
Mary Jean Rusha, something like that.
Oh, okay. I probably know it.
Okay. I'm not really on to her last name, but it's something like the Rusha. But she was there with her new husband. Well, they've been married a while.
And
that was to see her because she recognized me. I mean, she heard me talking. And she came up to me. She says, "Hodgman, is that you? I like your voice." And I hadn't seen her in I don't know how many years.
Mm-hmm.
It really was something to connect with her like that.
All right. Good, good.
Yeah.
All right. So. Yeah. Listen, I gotta do some homework for class. So.
Okay.
I gotta get busy.
Yeah. All right. Get busy.
I'll see you guys Sunday.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Have a great evening.
Yeah, come out to Long. Listen, so, you know, in Queens, they're going to have a meeting. I'll be sitting in on a meeting.
Uh-huh.
So I'm invited to the meeting, I should say.
Okay, so I need to drive.
And I mean, you guys are welcome to come. I don't know about the meeting, though. They seem very guarded about their meetings.
I don't need to be at the meeting.
I mean, you can always take the car and do something and come back and get me.
Hang on your car until you call us and say, come back and get me.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that could happen.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Okay.
All right.
All right.
Good night,
have fun. All right.
You too.
All right.
Thank you both. Love you.
Okay. Love you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.